I think the most difficult thing is, you know, people who are still with their families. The big difference with people who are mixed race or multiracial is Black people, South Asian people, Southeast Asian people go out into the world, they go to school, they go to work, they go to university, they use the transport system, they socialise, and they encounter racism, okay? They go home and shut the door and the racism is outside. But for some mixed race people and multiracial people, it's in the house, it's in your home, it's your mum or dad or your grandparents.
Welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you get the clients you want and create the practice of your dreams. Just a quick note before we begin. We had a few technical issues with the sound during this episode. You might find it easier to listen with headphones or in a quiet space. That said, it's such a valuable conversation with Yvonne that I really wanted to share it with you. And if you'd prefer to read, you'll find the transcript in your podcast app. In today's episode, I'm talking to Dr. Yvonne Guest, an experienced therapist, speaker, and trainer whose work centres around race, identity, and wellness. She is a contributor to the book called Black Identities, White Therapy, and her chapter is Negotiating the Faustian Pact, a psychosocial approach to working with mixed race people. I'd be really interested to hear a bit more about that. She's particularly passionate about supporting mixed and multiracial clients, and she's organising a conference on this theme, which she'll tell you about later. And this is what we're going to be talking about today, how therapists can better support clients of mixed heritage, what often gets missed, what's needed in the room, and how we can all approach this work with more awareness, care, and courage. So Yvonne,
great. Yeah.
Thank you for being here. Welcome. It's really good to see you.
Josephine, it's really nice to meet you, yeah. Finally.
I've
been in your Facebook group for a long time.
That's it. And it's been nice. You know, we've sort of met each other virtually via the Facebook group, but it's nice to finally meet each other face-to-face, albeit in a recording studio online. Well, let's get started, Yvonne. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and what drew you to working therapeutically with mixed and multiracial clients.
Okay, so I trained originally with Relate in Bristol. I was the first person of African Caribbean heritage to train with Relate in Bristol.
Wow.
And that was about 96 I started that. So I did my training, saw very few clients who weren't white, very few. I think I saw two in a 6-year period. And I did the psychodynamic training to work with couples and individuals. I always felt something was missing. And of course, now we work intersectionally, but I didn't have the language for that at the time.
Yes.
So I went off to do a PhD in resilience and trauma, and I had used my counselling skills in that. So I came out of that in about 2015 and thought I'd like to go back into counselling work and bring all the skills I've learned about resilience and trauma and that knowledge. And my first two clients were mixed race.
Right.
And I'd expected to get from my advertising, because my PhD was about people who've been in care.
Yeah.
And people who've been adopted. And I just thought I'd get lots of that.
Yeah.
And I got two mixed race people. And I just thought, oh, this is interesting. I'd done a little bit of research in my PhD on the mixed race experience, but from a sort of sociological perspective. And I thought, oh, so what am I going to do when the person in front of me is so like me?
Yeah.
How do I keep the distance as well as having the empathy and the understanding? And I thought, well, I'll go and do some reading, find some training. And there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And I just thought, okay, right. Well, I'm a little bit ahead because I've done the PhD and explored some of it. One of the people I'd interviewed was mixed race, so I'd done quite a bit of reading for her story. So that was 2016. And then I started to get more and more people who were mixed. And I just thought, oh, okay.
That's amazing though, isn't it? To think that, you know, even, I mean, it's not that long ago, less than 10 years ago, you couldn't find anything on therapy with mixed and multiracial people. Shocking really, isn't it? That, you know, it hadn't been considered before then. Yeah.
No, we had been ignored. And a good example of that is 2018, Therapy Today, devoted the October edition to Black History Month.
Yeah.
And did a first time ever, I think the whole magazine was devoted to a conversation about race. And there was a lot of excitement. Wow, you know, this is really changing. Because this was before George Floyd, so this was big, you know, in the therapy world. But there was nothing about the mixed race, multi-heritage experience. So between them, the entire therapy world, black, brown and white, had rendered us invisible, even in the spaces where we seek help and the spaces where we try to help.
Yeah.
So I spoke to the editor and, you know, voiced all my anger, I think is the right word. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, well, you know, you can have your own article.
Yeah.
So I wrote something 6 months later. And it was called Between Black and White. And it was about the whole world that does exist between black people and white people.
Yeah.
It just doesn't include, it's not just about people who are mixed or multi-heritage, but it's about people whose racialized identity is neither black nor white either.
Yeah.
So, so that kind of got us into the conversation. That's 2019.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just really sort of shocked that it's so recent, really, only sort of like the last 5 years. And I suppose, as you say, you know, we've had the George Floyd as sort of part of that in raising people's awareness around issues around black identity. Do you think it's getting better? Do you think that there's more now about multiracial people, or is it, you know, still a paucity of available information?
There isn't enough. So I wrote that in 2019. I then wrote a chapter in the book, Black Identities, White Therapies, which was written kind of through the George Floyd murder.
Yeah.
But came out afterwards, just afterwards. So that was the first chapter in a book. And then I have written some other things that are more kind of like blog type things.
Yeah.
And then I wrote something for the Mixed Museum. There's a museum online for people of mixed heritage in the UK.
Yeah.
Last year. There are other people now who are writing.
Yeah.
There's a book coming out this year, which will be about people in multiracial families. There's a chapter that's just come out in a book. There's a book that's just come out called Black Women, Race, Black Women, Trauma and Therapy. And that has got a chapter in it by a mixed race practitioner. So it is slowly, we're not a very confident group. We haven't got to that place where we are vocal enough, but, you know, things are changing.
But it's really interesting though, isn't it? Because that raises the question as to sort of, in a sense, what is holding you back? And I think this brings on to this idea of the Faustian, I'm not quite sure how you say it. Pact.
It's a German, it's Eastern, let's call it Northern mythology.
Yeah.
And Faust was, I guess we would call him like a seer, a kind of magical figure, mystical figure.
Yeah.
Who in the myth, he sells his soul to the devil.
Right.
And he has no idea the value of his soul until he's sold it.
Right.
And he sold it in exchange for infinite knowledge.
Yeah.
But once he's done it, he realizes how incredibly important his soul is. Mm-hmm. And that's what a Faustian pact is.
Yeah.
It's when you knowingly or unknowingly give up something that you just don't understand the value of until you've lost it.
So could you explain that in the context of multiracial people?
Yes. So the reason I decided to use it in that context was because if you are mixed or multiracial heritage, it's highly unlikely in the UK that, well, you won't grow up with two parents of the same racialized identity. You just won't.
Yeah.
You just won't, because you can't be mixed unless they're one of one kind and one of another kind.
Yeah.
If you're multiracial heritage, then you're going to have maybe one parent who already has two racialized identities. For example, I work with people who are Pakistani and Jamaican, but they also have a white parent.
Right.
So this is now three identities.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And different histories there.
Yes. I also work with people whose families have been mixing for generations.
Yeah.
So you're going back two or three generations of mixing. So you could have about 6, 7, 8 different racialized identities.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complex work. It's complex work.
I was just sort of thinking there when you were talking about Pakistani and Jamaican heritage, about sort of generational trauma, because you've got different streams of generational trauma, haven't you? Because you've got the sort of slavery side of thing, and then you've also got the sort of partition side of things as well. So rejection, captivity, you know, just within that.
A lot.
Just within that, yeah, yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So the first impact comes in, because a lot of mixed and multiracial people are kind of steered towards one identity.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the clients I work with are quite often raised in white spaces, not exclusively, but quite often raised in white spaces,
mm-hmm.
quite often with a single white mother.
Yeah.
So they've been raised in white spaces and they've just identified with whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
And so consciously or unconsciously, they've been steered towards whiteness, towards assimilation, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And they've no idea what's missing. Is their Black identity or their South Asian identity or their Southeast Asian identity? They don't realize the value of that until they start to think about their identity, which is usually around adolescence.
Yeah.
It's a very strong time for thinking about your identity for lots of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then they want to reclaim that identity. And then another struggle begins, which is trying to reclaim an identity in a community that doesn't recognize you because you're culturally raised as white.
Yeah. There's quite a lot of loss there, isn't there, as well?
There's a lot of loss. A lot of loss.
You know, I was just sort of thinking, it's reminding me, and I can't remember the name of the poet, but there's a really incredibly powerful book. It's the story of, it's a particular poet in the UK who grew up as a Black boy in a white family, I think.
And was that Lem Cisse?
Yeah. Yeah, that's who I'm trying to think of. And just even things like, you know, his hair was always such a problem to his white mother, I think.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like that sense of you belong, but you don't belong. And, you know, you might be rejected for certain things because you look different growing up in that white culture. It seems to be that can be problematic for people.
I think the biggest problem is it's inconsistency. So I always think about it like going to a house party.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're mixed and you go to a house party, let's say you go into the kitchen first,
mm-hmm.
and everybody in the kitchen's white,
mm-hmm.
and you're mixed. Not everybody in the kitchen is going to see you in the same way.
Yeah.
No one's going to see you as white.
Yeah.
Unless you are white presenting, which means nobody would know that you weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say I walked into that kitchen and everybody was white. Some people go, oh, she's black. I think she's black. And some people go, oh, she could be mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are like, I don't really care. She looks like a nice person.
Mm-hmm.
And some people go, like, I don't want her here, whatever she is. You know, you're going to get such a range of reactions from people. And then some people say, I accept her for however she identifies. So what? You know, she identifies, I accept her identification. You go into the next room, everybody's black. You're going to have the same procedure. Oh, yeah. I think she's black. I don't think she's black. I think she's white. I think she's mixed. I accept her for who she is. You're going to have exactly the same range of different reactions. You go into another room. Let's go say you go upstairs. And they're all mixed. And you're going to have the same responses. People are going to have already decided as soon as they see you what they think you are and what they think your identity is or should be.
Yeah.
So if you think about growing up in a family that behaves like that,
mm-hmm.
if your family is interracial, you could be getting that from your mum, from your dad, from your grandparents, from your aunts and uncles, from your cousins.
Mm-hmm.
You go out into your immediate community, you go to school, you socialize, you're getting that in your community. And if you think about what that would set up for you emotionally and psychologically, that's a lot of inconsistent messages that you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
When you try and work out who you are, and maybe you do, but, you know, I'm 63, I'm very clear about who I am and how I identify. Even when you get to my age and you've done that, you're still confronted by people who will tell you.
Yeah. Tell you who you are. Yeah.
They will tell you who you are.
Yeah. And for someone like myself who just looks completely white, that's such a position of privilege, really. We, you know, you just go into a room and you just expect everybody to accept you. The question doesn't arise, does it? It doesn't arise, well, who do people think I am? You know, it's obvious.
It's more complicated because there are a lot of mixed race people who are white presenting.
Yeah.
So this is where it gets really complicated. And I've got more and more clients lately who are white presenting. And it's almost a bit like pronouns. It's almost like you don't know. I've sat with clients and I've sat with them for weeks and then they've said, I am mixed. Or they've just let it slip.
Yeah.
You know, my mum's actually Indian or
Jamaican.
So for white presenting people, that's a whole other issue because they, so I've worked with white presenting people who have been brought up very firmly in their South Asian culture or their Caribbean culture or their African culture. But when they go out and try and claim it in the world, everybody says no. Says no. I'm not buying it. You're not that.
Yeah, it's just that sort of thought of having to navigate the world and having to navigate all these different people making assumptions about who you are and telling you where you do and don't belong effectively. And almost like not being believed. That seems to be what's coming up for me listening to what you're saying.
I think a lot of clients have problems with authenticity. They're trying to be their authentic selves. And that's very hard if people don't believe you. So yes, people don't believe you, which creates doubts in your own mind. I find that a lot of my clients are very dissociated. And I put that on a spectrum because a lot of my PhD around, because my PhD was about resilience and trauma. And I looked at dissociation very deeply. So if you put dissociation on a spectrum, down this end on the left-hand side, you'd have all the wonderful things about dissociation, because it's where we get to be creative. We are in a dissociated space when we create. We're in a dissociated space when I'm writing academically. I used to cycle around Bristol and there was a roundabout I used to have to navigate, and I used to hate that roundabout, and I used to go around it and through it and not know. So I would dissociate in order to do that. Children actually dissociate when they're learning.
If
it's something complex, they will dissociate. So there's this lovely end of the spectrum, which is like a lot of my clients are creatives, they are academics, they are musicians, they're incredibly creative people. So the dissociation is wonderful. On the other end of the spectrum, if there's a lot of trauma involved, that gets trickier, and that can start to look like depersonalization and derealization. So you're not really clear whether you're... And I'll be honest with you, some of my clients don't really believe that they exist. It's that bad. We're having conversations that become very existential. Because they're not really sure that they exist.
They've got sort of nothing to ground them, in a sense, in there.
There's nothing to ground them. I always feel like I'm pulling them out of the ether. And there's something, you can't see it, but there's something on my wall here that I find in our journey. It's about speaking ourselves into existence.
Right.
And even as practitioners, that's what we're doing now with the writing that we're doing. So we're speaking ourselves and writing ourselves into existence. It feels very existential. A lot of the work I do sometimes feels very existential.
Yeah, so you're helping them speak themselves into existence, because often they aren't believed. Their existence, in a sense, isn't believed by people, because other people are defining who they are, and it doesn't sort of accord with who they know themselves to be.
But it has to be viable. You see, your identity has to be viable, which it has to be supported by the environment around you. So like I said, even if you get to my age and you decide what you are, the environment around you might still say no. So this is the problem. This is the problem. And I say to my clients, you know, your identity has to be viable. You can decide clearly, categorically, what you're going to be. But is it viable in your environment? Are people going to support you in that identity? No, sometimes the answer is no.
So what impact would that have on people on a day-to-day basis? I mean, what sort of...
All my clients say it's exhausting.
Yeah.
exhausted, because that house party scenario, that's happening every day. You could be going from meetings to another meeting, on the bus, in a shop, home to family. It's exhausting, number one.
And I was going to say, you know, for multiracial people as well, do they, I mean, obviously you get some who are white presenting, but for others, are they sort of like experiencing racism, but that almost isn't acknowledged because they're not, say, black enough to be thought to be experiencing racism?
There was a kind of mythology for what I call monoracial people, who aren't white, but are monoracial in another racialized identity, that somehow mixed race people don't experience as much racism. As I said, a lot of my clients grew up in white spaces. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, I might have a client that grew up in the north of England in a very small town with a lot of racism. Mm-hmm. So then it's like you're the only one.
Yeah.
You're going to get all of it.
Mm-hmm.
All of it. Like an entire town's racism. You're going to get all of it from the ones who are racist, you know.
But and no one else who's going through the same experience as you. So it's a very lonely.
No one to talk to about it.
Yeah, really lonely experience, yeah.
If your mum's white, however much she loves you, and I've got a lot of clients whose mums were white, and they love them very much, but they didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And so it was a very lonely experience, which adds to the dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the mixed museum piece that I wrote, something I hear typically is, you know, I grew up in Devon.
Mm-hmm.
I got called the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm in black spaces, people tell me to be quiet because I don't understand racism.
Right, yeah.
And that has there's a historic reason for that, which is something else. I mean, I was thinking about, oh my God, Joseph Fee is white. Okay, I'm going to have to explain a lot, which is really good because it stops me from assuming that everybody knows what I'm talking about.
I think it's really helpful to hear because a lot of us, you know, won't have worked with multiracial clients, and that's why you're on the show. So tell us more.
Okay. So there's two reasons why the black community or the South Asian community might think that mixed race people are having a better experience.
Yeah, like, easier time.
One is, in somewhere like Jamaica, which is my heritage, in Jamaica, it was always the case that the lighter your skin colour was, the better life chances you had.
Yeah.
You'd get the best jobs. You'd get the government jobs. You'd have more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are families in Jamaica that deliberately kept themselves light-skinned for generations, which meant they didn't marry darker-skinned people.
Right.
And if they did, I've worked with people whose relatives gave those children away.
Right, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So they wanted to keep them light-skinned because that meant, it literally meant the difference between a good quality of life and a really, really awful quality of life.
Yeah.
That comes out of slavery. That comes out of slavery because the house slaves tended to be lighter-skinned than the field slaves.
Yeah.
Okay? So that comes out of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the situation in Jamaica. If you try and translate that to the UK, it doesn't work because not all mixed race people are lighter skinned.
Mm-hmm.
I've had clients who are Indian and African.
Mm-hmm.
They are darker than most black people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're definitely darker than most Indian people. Mm-hmm. So there's a mythology that all mixed race people are light skinned because they're not.
Yeah.
They're not all white because some of them don't have any whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and also it's very different to be mixed race than it is to be light skinned. If you could have two black parents and be light skinned because DNA loves to surprise us.
Yeah.
You can be light skinned and have two black parents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You can be mixed race and not have any white parents. The trouble with being mixed race for all racial groups is a mixture of fear of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be kind and say it's fear of the other on this end of the spectrum. I love a spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, it's downright racism.
Yeah.
I don't want my daughter marrying your son because you're different to us.
Yeah.
And I don't like your group, you know, and I'm going to be as racist as I can because I just don't want it, that kind of thing. And that happens in all racialized groups. So it's very difficult to translate something that is about Jamaica into something about being light-skinned in Jamaica to something that's about being mixed race in the UK.
Yeah.
Okay, because to be mixed race could mean and to be multiracial could mean that nobody's happy about the fact that somebody's been racially mixing. Mm-hmm. No one's happy about it.
Mm.
So there's a difference. Mm-hmm. And this is why there's this kind of mythology that all mixed race people and multiracial people don't experience racism.
Mm-hmm. And how about racism that they might have internalized as well?
Yes. So a lot of the work I do is about internalized racism, because we all internalize it. And that is a lot of the work that we do, is unpacking that, mm-hmm. and looking at that, because it will have happened. And yeah. for multiracial people, there's just more of it.
Yeah. Because you talk about, is there pressure to choose a side, do you think?
Yes.
Go on, tell us a bit more about that.
There is. I think, look at the world as it is now racially.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the world as it is racially. How could there not be pressure when mm-hmm. you look at what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
It's so bad. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's gotten worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten so much worse. So if you look at the rhetoric around immigration yeah. all over the world, not just this country.
Yeah.
But look at the rhetoric and the racist rhetoric that I think really took off with Brexit.
Yeah.
Then it's going to be very difficult to... It's not about taking a side, because I'm mixed race, but of course I'm an ally to black people and I'm anti-racist. But I want to reserve the right for my own identity, to self-define my own mm-hmm. identity
mm-hmm.
as mixed. That doesn't mm-hmm. mean I'm not an ally. It does not mean I'm not anti-racist. But for some people, it can feel like... So I talk not just about the Faustian Pact, I talk about no man's land.
Yeah.
So if you think about the war, First World War, and that iconic idea of a no man's land between two entrenched positions,
yeah,
it can feel like that. That you're in no man's land. You're in no man's land.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous place.
I was going to say, attacked from both sides.
It's a dangerous place, but you can get caught in the crossfire as well. So it's more like we are saying, can we please choose our own identities? But that can be seen as you're choosing a side.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not. We're just saying, I'd like to choose my own identity.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Because you've also talked about how there might be a burden for people of mixed race because of the sort of historical facts.
Yes, there is a burden, and it works in many different ways. I mean, something that's coming into my practice more and more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to move the conversation away from a black and white conversation, because so many people are multiracial heritage. And so many people, Rihanna Garrett is a phenomenal young woman who's Southeast Asian and white.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just done her PhD. She's going to be talking at the conference I'm going to talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
And she has shown me that we need to move the conversation away from the conversation being about blackness and whiteness.
Yeah, one or the other.
A lot of mixed people are not black, and some of them aren't black or white.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, Justin, I've lost my thread as usual.
Yeah, you were saying about that there might not be two sides. It's not one or the other. We need to acknowledge that it's more than just that binary. Again, it comes back to binary, doesn't it? You know, it's not one or the other. There's all sorts of things in between.
I think, so there's a brilliant BBC 4 radio show that I listen to about nuanced thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the takeaway I took was that binary thinking, it's inherent. We're mm-hmm. predetermined. It's what kept us safe. You know, you stepped out of the cave and you went, oh, that's a tiger. That's definitely bad.
Yeah.
There's a carrot. That's good. It's yeah. not going to bite me, you know.
Yeah.
So in a very simple way, we're predetermined to be binary thinkers, to choose very quickly, well, that's good and that's bad, right?
Yeah.
Add in the fear of the stranger, and you're walking along going, well, I have no idea. That person looks nothing like me. They could be just dreadful, you know.
Yeah.
And the last time people like that came, they killed a lot of us.
Yeah.
So nuance has to be taught.
Yeah.
Nuance is not inherent, and yeah. nuance has to be taught.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when we talk about race and gender, if there's two things that are going to, you know, create chaos, it's really hard to get away from these binary ideas that you're one thing, that you can only be one thing or another.
Yeah. It's lots and lots of different identities, isn't it, from what you're saying? This is what I'm hearing you say. And I'm sure sort of like, you know, obviously there's lots of different identities amongst white people and amongst black people. But
absolutely,
you know,
absolutely.
It's learning that, I guess, again, it just comes back to learning to take each individual as they are. But that for mixed and multiracial people, there's this additional burden, really, that you've been talking about of not being believed for who you are and having to bear the sort of weight of other people's assumptions and expectations about who you are. And that in itself is, like you say, it's fatiguing to have to keep sort of trying to prove yourself.
Well, if you're different in any way in this society, because I've worked a lot with disabled people as well, if you're different and you look different, people out there in the public feel you owe them a narrative.
Yeah.
They feel you owe them a narrative. They feel you owe them a story.
Mm.
They want to know what your story is.
Yeah.
So there's differences between people who are monoracial and people who are mixed or multiracial.
Mm.
Is, you know, it is predominantly people of colour who get asked where you're from.
Yeah.
It is. So there's where are you from, which automatically implies I'm not sure you belong here, so I need to know where you're from.
Yeah.
But for people who are mixed and multi-heritage, there's another question, which is, what are you?
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people are rude enough to actually say, what are you?
Yeah.
But there's always an implied, yeah, but what are you?
I
need to know what the mix is. You're not mono, so what's the mix?
Yeah.
To be asked, where are you from, gives you that feeling, well, I don't feel like you're including me. I don't feel like I belong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to be asked, what are you, is actually something about a question about your right to be.
Yeah, it's an existential question.
So we get back to the existential conversations.
Yeah.
You know? Do I have a right to be if people keep saying to me, what are you?
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you work this? How do you help clients to sort of work with this? Is it sort of like, I suppose the question is, like, counsellors who work with transgender clients will say, well, they'll come to me about all sorts of things. They're not necessarily coming to me about their identity.
That's exactly the same.
So, it's the same for you. But do you find that there are people coming to you to work on their identity? And if so, how do you help them? What sort of things, how do you work with them in therapy?
Well, you touched earlier on loss,
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of loss.
Yeah.
A loss of identity, a loss of culture. That never having felt that they belong.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of mixed-race people will always struggle with that sense of belonging because things are always shifting. The world is always shifting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's loss. So that's the way we'd work with any kind of loss.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledge it. I think what I notice most about clients when I first meet them, and I always do a consultation, is they talk.
Yeah.
Or they cry. They cry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay. Then they're like, oh, I didn't think I'd do this. And I'm going, yeah, but you've never had the space.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing. We forget this as practitioners, how important just creating the space is.
Yeah.
To sort we of need to lean into our magic boxes. The space is huge, you know, the space is huge.
Yeah.
So just coming into the space and holding the space for people is huge. So there's loss and grief. I think the most difficult thing is, you know, people who are still with their families. Because the big difference for people who are mixed race or multiracial is black people, South Asian people, Southeast Asian people go out into the world, they go to school, they go to work, they go to university. They use the transport system, they socialise, and they encounter racism, okay? Mm. They go home and shut the door and the racism's outside.
Yeah.
But for some mixed-race people and multi-race people, it's in the house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's in your home. It's your mum or dad or your grandparents. So the complicated thing for mixed and multi-race people is it's that really difficult thing of two things being true at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother loves me,
mm-hmm.
but she would really prefer it if I wasn't mixed.
Yeah.
She loves me, but she doesn't love my Jamaican dad.
Yeah.
Or my Nigerian mum loves me, but she doesn't love my white grandparents.
Mm.
or that auntie and uncle, they're all right with us because they've got mixed race kids as well. So again, you're back to the inconsistency, but it's about what's going on in your family. This is supposed to be your safe place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have worked with people whose parents were ashamed of them. They loved them, but they were ashamed of them. Because you have to remember, some of my clients, the oldest client I've worked with is in their 70s, so I'm 63.
Mm-hmm. So it's been born in the 50s or something like that. So
people were born in the 50s or 60s. Mm. An interracial relationship then would have been frowned on by everybody.
Yeah.
Literally everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, there would have been mums and dads who were ashamed.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess it's lonely as well, because if your parents are sort of from monoracial, you know, you've got maybe a white mum and a black dad or vice versa or whatever, and you're mixed race, neither of your parents can really understand your particular experience, can they?
They never will.
Mm.
They never will. And I've only realised, I was talking to somebody I supervise who's mixed, and I said, I've just clicked, you know, there's something on a very fundamental level of getting your needs met as a child that can't be met.
Mm.
That can't be met. You need other mixed adults around you who can role model for you and talk to you.
It's a huge gap, isn't it?
So no, if you've got monoracial parents, that's going to make... So I often think of those families and I think, well, so let's say dad's Chinese. I walk around Bristol, I see the most incredible mixes because obviously I'm always looking.
Yeah.
I walk around Bristol, I literally see Africans with Chinese people. I'm thinking, okay, you've got Nigerian dad, Chinese mum, mixed race child. None of you are having the same experience. Dad's not having the same experience as mum. I have no idea what it's like to be black.
Yeah.
I have no idea what it's like to be white.
Mm-hmm.
I have absolutely no idea what it's like to be white.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't understand my mum. I wouldn't understand my dad. They wouldn't understand me. So there's a whole family there having completely different experiences.
What would you like therapists to know, do you think, about working with mixed race, multiracial clients? What do they
need
to know?
Number one, don't make assumptions. That person who looks white might not be white.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, don't look at someone's face and think that you know who they are.
Yeah.
And I think it comes back to cultural humility. You have that cultural humility, which is, to me, to me, the biggest component of cultural humility is admitting that we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like this idea of cultural competence that you can go off and learn and learn and learn and learn, because I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I'd like to start from a place of I know a little bit. I know what it's like for me to be mixed race, but the clients I work with, their stories are different, very different.
Yeah, everybody's got different stories. That's a really interesting point, not cultural competence, but cultural humility.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like that.
Yeah. Things like gender play a different role. You've got to be keeping your ear out for gender issues as well, because it's very different to be a pretty mixed race girl to being a pretty mixed race boy. Because in the black community, if there's culture of hyper masculinity, being a pretty mixed race boy is not going to do you any favours.
Yeah.
You might be seen as gay.
Yeah. If this conversation has left you reflecting on your own practice, how you show up, what you bring, and who you're best placed to help, then Therapy Growth Group might be a great opportunity for you to work this out. Currently, we're working through the 12 action steps to attract new clients. And when this podcast goes out, we're just reaching the part where we talk about your niche, your profile, and how to write it. So if you're thinking about how you can write to show your identity as a therapist, this is a great time to be part of the group. It's all about discovering what sets you apart and helping the right clients recognise that about you too. So whether you're unsure about how to describe your approach, you're still finding your feet with marketing, or you just need some more support, then do come along to Therapy Growth Group. Just go along to josephinehughes.com, and on the front page, you'll see a link to the group where you can find out more about it. And now let's get back to listen to Yvonne. How about the fear of saying the wrong thing? Because I think this is sometimes something that particularly white therapists can worry about is, you know, what if I say the wrong thing? What if I point it out? You know, is it appropriate for me to say something? What do you think about those sorts of questions?
I think it's a difficult one because I think we need to be curious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's a positive tool in our toolbox. I think we've become so fearful of rupture,
mm-hmm.
we're forgetting that it also can provide an opportunity to repair.
Yeah.
If you can navigate a rupture with a client and repair it, that's so powerful for them and you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I still do not get it right with people. Yeah. I am shockingly bad. I am so bad at pronouns. I try so hard. I can do the they, them and all that, but when I have to talk about somebody's sibling, I'm like, is it a sister? I'm really bad.
Yeah.
But because my LGBTQ clients are so patient and generous,
mm-hmm.
oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
You've got my name right.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think it's the intention. I think people can really pick up on the intention.
Yeah. It's the intention.
Mm.
And I think we're so scared now of causing a rupture. We're forgetting that, well, yes, if you do, but and then you repair it.
Yeah.
So I had a terrible rupture at the beginning of a relationship with a client. I actually hadn't done anything. It was just a very, it was like that. The space was so big. It was almost like anything that anybody would have said would have been a big trigger. But mm-hmm. it turned into a huge rupture, which mm-hmm. we survived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was a brilliant piece of work, and changing that person was huge. Sometimes we don't even do anything and we create rupture.
Yeah.
We haven't done anything.
Yeah. Something might trigger somebody and we just got no idea that there's a trigger there. Yeah.
But that's the whole point of a trigger, isn't it? You see, because for us to go around thinking I might trigger a client,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of naive because, yes, we will.
Yeah.
We will. And the whole point of a trigger is it's something that bypasses the normal, you know, the brain's normal cognitive. It's a trigger. And,
yeah.
and that's why it gets such a strong reaction. Mm. We can't avoid triggering clients. Mm-hmm. We just can't.
It's part of the work.
It's part of the work. And we forget about the repair part and the opportunity to repair.
Mm.
I would wonder if I went through an entire year of work and hadn't triggered somebody or got something wrong, I'd be worried because I'd be thinking, well, am I just so fearful that I'm constantly guarding? What kind of relationship am I creating if I'm so constantly guarding?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you do get it wrong, and I do, then the first thing you say is, wow, I got that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I got that so wrong. I did not get that right for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah.
I learned that from doing my research interviews
mm-hmm.
because it was supposed to be a life story approach, which is very much more like a person-centered approach.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd find that I'd been leading or misleading, and then I'd have to listen to the interview and go, that was a bit leading.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to take that back and unpick that with the person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stopped thinking I've got to avoid being leading or misleading. And I started thinking, yeah, but how quickly do I repair it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
How quickly do I repair it? Because that's more the focus, I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's really helpful, actually, Yvonne, because I think so many of us are so scared of getting things wrong. Like you say, we're so scared of the rupture that actually asking ourselves, you know, how can I repair? It's a more helpful question rather than how can I avoid it. So could you tell us about your conference then? Because that was part of the reason why I invited you on, because you've got a conference coming up in November, haven't you? So tell us about that.
Whoa, this has been a journey.
Yeah.
Okay. So all of last year I was like, what am I going to do? I don't want to write anything else. I've written a few pieces and...
Yeah.
What do I want to do? I don't want to write a book. I wrote a bloody book. I did my PhD. That's one bloody book. It's 80,000 bloody words. I do swear a lot. I haven't done the F-bomb today, so you usually do a few F-bombs. I thought, oh, my God, what can I do? And I just thought, so it was December,
mm-hmm.
my last thing before I finished. I was so tired, because we are, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
I shot off an email to online events mm-hmm. to John Wilson and Sandra Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And said, I did this kind of hyper pitch.
Yeah.
I got this idea of this groundbreaking, innovative conference that's never been done before. And then I got that thing, like, you know, put a date in the calendar.
Yeah.
Got that file. And then we met in January and I met with John, freezing cold. And I was here in my little pod talking to John. And I was doing this elevator pitch, you know, elevator pitch. And I was pitching away and John just went, okay, so let's say, let's put a date in. And
yeah.
I went, what? And he said, let's put a date in. I'm going to do it now. I just burst into tears.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I said, I'm looking for a tissue.
Yeah.
I've got one down here. I just said, you've no idea how much this is going to mean to people like myself.
Yeah.
Not just practitioners, but clients. And John, like yourself, he had no idea what I was talking about, about being mixed race and multiracial. So he's been on a big learning curve.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I talked to John and John said yes, and we put the date in for November. This was January. And then afterwards, I thought, oh, my God, that's so unprofessional. I was crying. So I messaged my closest colleague and friend, who's also a mixed practitioner. I said, I just cried all over John Wilson. she was like so manically excited.
Yeah.
And then I started emailing people and saying, will you talk? And they were just, it was just this mania. I had 42 presenters.
Good grief.
And it was insane. I got down to 24 now, which is still a lot.
That's a lot, isn't it? It's going to be a really rich conference.
We had 42.
Yeah.
Down to 24.
Yeah. It sounds like it might be something that it isn't just the first one. It sounds like there's going to be a series of
them. There is going to be another one.
Yeah.
There is going to be another one. This is the first one. So we got the presenters sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started all the beautiful artwork was done by Sandra Wilson. And I loved her kaleidoscope. That made it for me.
Mm.
And then, you know, emailing people and asking them to present was a roller coaster. The kind of responses I was getting, like, oh my God.
Mm.
It was like to be suddenly seen, the thought of being seen and heard and having a space and such a big space and such a big platform was completely overwhelming.
From everything you've said about just how ignored and how unrecognised people in multiracial communities have been, it's no wonder that you were crying and that people are really excited about it, because it's finally
people were emailing me and saying I'm crying.
Yeah
And I was emailing back saying, well, so am I. And there was a lot of that, and like, so exciting.
Yeah,
everybody was so excited.
Yeah.
And I spoke to John a couple of weeks ago and he said it's unprecedented the number of sales we've had before.
Really?
That's never had this number of ticket sales.
Wow. So it's really needed. There's a lot of interest there for people. So what, forgive me for asking such a basic question, but why should someone sort of attend, do you think? What will they get out of it?
I think the loveliest thing about it is you will see every kind of person, every racial group, not just the mixed ones. There's some people are presenting who aren't mixed, which I wanted their take on it as well.
Yeah.
So I've got two or three people who aren't mixed. When you look at the posters, one poster with all of our faces, you can't tell.
Yeah.
Who's mixed and who isn't.
Which is interesting in itself, isn't it?
There's about four white presenting people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you'd go, oh, there's four white people and there's four black people. Mm. And I know who they are.
Yeah.
So if you look at the poster, you'll be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I think come, because it's such an inclusive day.
Yeah.
It's not a black event.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a South Asian event.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a white event. I don't think you'll go to a more inclusive conference this year.
Yeah.
Because it's not a monoracial event.
It's 28th of November, isn't it? Is that right? Yeah. And people can buy tickets via online events. And what I'll do is I'll add the URL into the show notes so that people can easily get through to buy the tickets. And are you speaking?
I am doing something on trauma and resilience and working with people who are mixed and multiracial heritage.
Yeah.
So it's nice to bring my PhD work into the conference.
It's sort of like come full circle by the sounds of things.
Yeah, it's nice to bring the two together. I've never brought the two together this clearly, so it's nice to bring the two together.
Fantastic. So conference papers maybe will be the next thing. Get a book out of the conference papers.
Yeah, there's somebody talking who's got a book coming out, and there's a book coming out around the time of the conference as well.
Yeah.
So I think what I've noticed in our community of practitioners is a lot more confidence. A lot more people are writing, presenting, speaking out.
Yeah.
So I think you'll see next year and the year after, you'll see a real outpouring of more resources.
And we need it, don't we? Let's be frank. Like you said, back when you looked, 2016 was it, there just wasn't anything. So, you know, we need more and you know, people need to know more, don't they, to understand if they do get a mixed race or multiracial client, to understand what some of the issues might be. Yvonne, thank you so much for such an interesting conversation, and good luck with the conference. Certainly whetted my appetite for it. And I'll put the link in the show notes so other people can find it. Yeah, so thank you, Yvonne, very much for coming along. I really appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Josephine. That's really, really lovely. And it's great to talk to you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.